Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello. A very warm welcome in to RNIB Tech Talk, your regular source of accessible technology information, reviews and interviews from the perspective of blind and partially sighted people. It is, of course, your opportunity to connect with the world of technology. We'd love to know how's it going, what's getting a thumbs up or a thumbs down from you. Send us an email or a good old-fashioned voice note, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. You know that email address by now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be speaking with the team from Plane Studios, who are joining us to talk about how they are attempting to make use of AI to make images on the web more accessible. Callum Stoneman tests the WeWalk app, and we'll be hearing from him a little bit later on. And we will be thinking about Global Accessibility Awareness Day, looking at some of the trends in global technology and catching up with our friends from Thomas Pocklington Trust and Leonard Cheshire. So that's all to come this time on Tech Talk. Welcome in to my co-host this week, the aforementioned Callum Stoneman. How are you, sir?
Yeah, doing good, thanks. Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. What's troubling you? What's on your mind? What's coming across your desk? What are you finding in your technology in tray this week?
Well, we've had a bit of news from Apple this week. They announced that Logic Pro and Final Cut Pro are coming to the iPad. So Final Cut is their kind of video editing software, and then Logic is very well known. It's their music production software, like professional music production. And these are two packages that have only really been available. Well, they've only been available on the Mac, and they're coming to the iPads now with the ones that have got the Apple chips. So just thought that was quite interesting. It's bringing this professional level music production and audio production to a bit more of an affordable market.
And the other big change there as well is the way you pay for it.
Yeah, they've gone to the subscription, which seems to be quite a common trend nowadays.
Speaking of announcements as well, recently we heard that raft of announcements from Google. Of course, they're very excited about their Bard AI, their sort of alternative, I guess, to ChatGPT. And they've announced a bunch of new Pixel devices, the 7A, so the more affordable Pixel 7 device. They've got a tablet now, and also a Fold as well. Would you like a smartphone that folds out into a tablet, Callum?
I don't know. I'm not into entirely sold on this Fold trend. Mind you, I probably need to see it, because I know the Samsung ranges, weren't they? They had the Samsung Galaxy Flip and the Samsung Galaxy Fold. Not entirely sure what the difference was, but I know they were popular for a bit, but I'm not sure. It feels a bit... I don't know.
Maybe it's more a visual thing. Perhaps, if you were partially sighted and you're somebody that wants that, immersive experience of watching a movie on a tablet or looking at photos, then perhaps, the benefit isn't necessarily for us as screen reader users, but maybe for someone who is partially sighted.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Well, let us know what you think about all of that. Lots more announcements to come. We've got the Microsoft Build conference. That's coming pretty soon as well. It's a busy time, Callum Stoneman.
It is. It's all happening.
So let us know what you think. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk. It's often said that one of the biggest challenges that faces us as blind and partially sighted people is access to information. And that often is no more the case than when you encounter an image on a web page. You know, the kind of thing where your screen reader says bitmap or graphic and you haven't got a Scoobies what's going on. And recently we are aware that, of course, there have been campaigns to encourage those who put images on web pages, whether that's social media sites or or other websites, there have been campaigns to encourage content creators and web developers to try and label those images, so those of us who are using screen reading software can have some idea about what's going on there. But let's be honest, not everybody does it. So one organisation who is attempting to come up with a solution, a bit of a workaround to try and solve this problem, is Plains Studio. And we're joined by the team at Plains Studio. We have Charlie, Henry and Elron joining us now. Thanks so much, folks, for being on RNIB Connect Radio. Can I just go around sort of each of you, get you to sort of introduce yourselves, tell me your title and your involvement with this project. Let's start with you, Charlie.
Thanks, Dave. Hiya, I'm Charlie. So I'm a product director here at Plains, and my involvement with AI, I came on to kind of work on it towards the end. So once we had the plugin ready to go, and my main focus was how we, I guess, get a beta version of it out there in the world, and mainly how we get feedback from screen reader users. So that's been my main focus for the last sort of month or two, is working with the team, and that's actually why we reached out to RNIB, was to plan some research around speaking to users with screen readers, and also getting them to actually use the plugin so we could observe any issues or blockers with the tool, and then use that to inform the next iteration of it before we actually go ahead and launch it, and just really wanting to make sure that it is actually solving the problem it's set out to solve. And if it isn't, how we can change it to make it better, or even pivot and move it in a slightly different direction. So that's been my focus, really.
Okay, Henry, let's come to you.
Hi there, Dave. Lovely to meet you. I'm Henry. I am one of the founders at Plains, and I'm also tech director, so I'm the techie co-founder at Plains. I have been involved with the project from the beginning. So Elleran and I actually worked on the first version of the product, of the plugin, and we built it actually as part of one of our internal hackathons. So it's where we as developers all got together and formed teams and kind of worked on our own individual ideas. Elleran and I kind of came up with the idea as we're sort of on the front line, obviously working with developers, and we're well aware of the problem of developers maybe missing those alt descriptions, those image captions all too often. So we figured with the recent advancements in AI, we kind of wondered how we could solve this problem for screen reader users in a bit of a different way. So that's kind of, I guess that's been my involvement.
Brilliant. And Elleran?
Hey Dave, I'm Elleran. I'm a software engineer in Plains. And as Henry said, we built it together as part of the hackathon as the first version. And then we're like, okay, it can actually help people. So we were deciding to build a real version and release it to the public and actually help people.
So my understanding of this project is that you are developing a plugin for the Chrome browser that will aim to use AI to describe images on the web. Can Henry perhaps just, could you sort of talk about the problem? How did you encounter this problem? How did you discover that this was an issue that blind and partially sighted people face? And why do you think the approach that you're taking is the best one?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess working in tech, your accessibility is a big part of I guess some of the requirements that come into building a product, right? So like, And we're super aware, we're hyper aware as a team, especially at Plains, of making sure we're checking all the boxes to ensure that our websites are as accessible as possible. But all too often, we'll be handed over the reins to a project, or we might work on an existing project, an existing code base. And quite often, you'll notice that developers just completely omit the alt description on images. So that's developers potentially being lazy or just not having the processes in place to enforce add image descriptions, but then also content creators. So as you were saying at the beginning, where you have a LinkedIn post or an Instagram post, and the content creator, whoever's uploaded the image, hasn't actually gone and written a caption for their image. these platforms are doing have implemented tools recently to better enforce adding captions, but we just know that it's like it's a really big problem because you've got so many different parties, sets of experience and understanding of the problem, uploading content to the internet and not attributing them. So we kind of approached it, I suppose, from a very techie perspective, thinking about it, how we could kind of come up with a tool that would be more one size fits all for the user, so that the internet almost didn't need to be aware of, in an ideal world, the internet users are all captioning images, but obviously in reality, that's been a problem. So a one size fits all solution that, as long as you're a Chrome user at the moment, you know, it's entirely possible for us to go and like build this for the different browsers. But as long as you're a Chrome user at the moment, you can go and add it into your Chrome browser and it will just automatically go and caption any image that doesn't already have an alt caption. And it does a relatively good job of it right now, but we kind of, there's definitely a roadmap for how we could go and improve that. So that's what we're kind of excited about at this point.
Charlie, you're leading on the testing. Just talk us through that user experience then. So what happens? What can testers expect as they start to try out the plugin and they open up web pages?
Yeah, so I guess there's a step almost before that, which is them downloading the plugin. And then once it's actually downloaded into there and they have it as a Chrome extension, it works and operates in the background and ideally just in unison with a screen reader. So the ideal situation is something that didn't have alt text there before, or AI would have automatically added that. And so for the user, the experience is enhanced either because there was nothing there in the first place, or the description, as you said, was really incomprehensible. And the idea being it can bring to life that image in a way that can help the user connect with it and really understand what's actually there. I think what we've been testing at the moment, and we've tested, we're kind of in early stages of testing it with users, and we're really starting to discover that there's lots of different ways in which people who are using screen readers actually access the internet. So there's a consideration around not actually everyone being familiar with Chrome or plugins. So even before you're using the plugin itself, there's that step that requires you to download it. And that, you know, potentially being something that people could encounter difficulties in at that point. And I think the other thing that we've really started to find from, or what we're hearing from users is it really depends on the different websites that you're using, and some of which seem better suited to all AI and some of which are kind of less suited. So like a news website versus a retail website, they require almost different functionality and a different user experience. So in terms of the roadmap for the future, I think what we're thinking about is narrowing in on what is the right use case for all AI and how might we need to evolve it, and let's say to work better across a retail website versus a blog versus, you know, BBC News and things like that. So those are all of the types of insights that are starting to come out through testing, and we'll start to sort of form that roadmap beyond what we've kind of got as the first version of it.
Eleron, I'm really interested to understand the sort of decisions that led you to kind of going for a kind of a browser-based plugin, because as Charlie mentioned, obviously there are lots of different ways in which blind and partially sighted people access the web. Some people are using different browsers. Some people go to, you know, mobile sites. I mean, in some ways, you could make a case for a server kind of based approach, where actually the web page, regardless of browser, is served up with these descriptions. What kind of made you decide that you think a Chrome plugin is sort of the best? Was it just about trying to work something up, a proof of concept to see if the idea works?
So yeah, the initial thought was the hackathon. So our hackathon was focused on the Chrome extensions. So as part of it, we said like, okay, we will develop a Chrome extension. And yeah, kind of a proof of concept. And we said like, okay, we can start there. It's a very simple thing to implement and to develop. It's quite straightforward, so you don't need to wiggle around, and you can deliver it very fast. And on the other side, like everyone is using Chrome today. Not everyone, but you know, most of the people are using Chrome or have a Chrome in their desktop machine. So it's a very easy one to handle.
Well, I'm using Edge at the minute, and there's Safari on my phone. So, Henry, how do you decide which images to describe? You'll be aware that not all images are created equal. As a blind user, I'm interested in those sort of functional images, maybe product images, but I don't necessarily need to know about top left-hand corner graphic or top right-hand corner graphic. You know, there are those sort of bits of furniture that sometimes where images are used, where maybe an alt tag is less appropriate. So how do you decide which images to describe?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's something that we've not, I think we're not super sophisticated with at this point. So, we noticed that a huge amount of images from our research, you know, they're either using just the word image, seemingly a lot of the time, or you know, like a variation of that. So we filter out those, so we consider that as not having an alt description. Sometimes they'll have things like a hyphenated string, and we can kind of recognize those, and we'll count that as not having an alt description. We've also recently implemented a simple mechanism just to filter out any images that are particularly small, so i.e. kind of like icons or things like that. But as you say, like those can often be functional and are particularly good, or a particularly good example of something that needs an alt description. So I think we could get a lot more sophisticated in that realm, in addition to having more contextual information fed into the AI model, so that we're able to kind of augment the alt description with the contextual information on a page. So there's definitely some more sophistication we can build into it, but we have some simple mechanisms in place at the moment.
Charlie, tell us a bit about the roadmap then. Where are you just now? You mentioned testing. Are we kind of early testing? Are you still looking for testers?
We're definitely still looking for testers. Yeah, absolutely. So we've done one round of qualitative research, which involved testing with five screen reader users between the age of sort of 20 and 50. And it was a mixture of some open questions around their day-to-day behaviours, and then actually, like I said, getting them to go through the whole process of downloading and using the plugin. So we're very much in the early stages of synthesising that and understanding, I guess, what the key takeaways are. And I think what we've learned from that has also made us realise we need to kind of do another round of testing, because some themes are coming up, but we're almost learning something new with every single user. And what we want to get to is the point that we've got, enough evidence, or we've tested with enough users that we can start to group some of those insights into themes. And that's really what will start to inform the kind of next iteration of the product. I think the other thing that's coming out, and this has been a theme among a number of different users, is people, and yeah, actually, David, it'd be great to hear your thoughts on this. We've definitely heard that people who are using screen readers often bypass images completely because the experience has been so broken for them in the past, and can be more effort than it's worth, or it's very hit and miss. So there's definitely almost a question there around how we might build trust back into being able to use this tool to make that experience better. But that's definitely like a barrier that I think will be something that we're thinking about in terms of the roadmap and how we can overcome that. But I think, yeah, in terms of immediate next steps, it's very much continue to test. We don't have enough feedback yet, and we're really looking for more people to do more rounds of research with us. And I think once we, kind of increase the amount of evidence we have, we can really start to build that roadmap out in a bit more detail. So it's probably too early to say exactly what's on that roadmap, but I'm hoping in the next month that's something that will come off the back of this round of research that we're doing.
Eleron, thinking about some of the ways in which AI is being used in accessibility, we've seen the Be My Eyes service. They're trialing a virtual volunteer type service where you can ask the AI questions about the image. Also, Envision have demonstrated something similar publicly. Have you given any thought to that? If you've generated a description for an image, it might be that I want to know something specific about that image, and that might be something that AI could help with.
Yeah, that's true. That's an option, like to upload an image and then like ask a question of like I don't know, like Be My Eyes is doing, although it's like between two people and you open your camera and then you help them. You can just upload an image and ask like, oh, where's my remote?
No, I mean the virtual. Sorry, Eleron, to cut you off there. They are now trialing a service called Virtual Volunteer, where they're using an AI instead of a human volunteer, where you take a picture and then you can ask the AI, GPT-4, I think it is, questions about that image.
Oh, really? I haven't seen
Yes.
it yet. No.
I think there's a waiting list to get on the beta, but yeah, the button is definitely there in the app.
I will have a try. Sounds cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. Yeah.
So that's actually the questioning an image is actually part of the model that we are using under the hood for Alt AI. So it's certainly something that we could relatively easily implement in with it within the extension, which is definitely interesting. I wasn't aware of that in Be My Eyes.
Yeah, so it, like you know, imagine on a website you've got an image of a product, and then potentially ask your screen reader to you know interrogate that further, or, you know via the plugin. There's lots of so much potential, isn't there,
Yeah, it
Henry?
really is.
Yeah. So what do we want folk to do? Charlie said that you're keen to get more people testing. What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, so the best way to do that, I think we did a shout out a couple of weeks ago through RNIB Connect, and we got some loads of great responses, and we've been reaching out to those people and setting up interviews. The best way, if anyone's interested in taking part in research sessions in the future, is just to shoot through an email to either myself or Henry. And I don't know whether there's a way to share that, Dave, after this, or otherwise we can just shout out what those emails are. And then we will reach out to you and set up a session. And it usually takes about 45 minutes. We send over some guidelines before in terms of how the session's going to be run and any instructions and things like that. And yeah, I mean, honestly, the more the better. So yeah, if there's a good way to share details, let me know. Otherwise, I can just read out our email so people can get in touch.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, if you've got a preferred contact email address where potential testers can find you, by all means, go ahead.
Cool. Yeah. So best way is just to reach out to me. So I'm just charlie.wileman@planes.studio. And you can just reach me directly and shoot an email through. So it's charlie.wileman, which is Wileman, at planes, planes.agency, agency. And we have, yeah, a form that we can also send over for feedback for people that are maybe don't have enough time to commit to a full interview, which is just a couple of quick questions around the tool and the value that it might be providing and any usability issues that people might have encountered. So there's two different routes to giving feedback, and both are really welcome and much needed.
Obviously, we're in really early stages. Yeah, as much feedback as we can get at this point, we'd be really excited to hear. And yeah, I just think there's like such a huge opportunity here for us to kind of really invest in and build something of real use. So really excited to be solving a real problem.
Charlie, Henry, and Elrond from Planes Studio. Thanks for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Cheers.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having us.
We've spoken to the company WeWalk a couple of times here on Tech Talk. They are the company behind the WeWalk Smart Cane, which is a white cane that has an ultrasonic sensor that is used to detect obstacles that are at head or chest height that you wouldn't really find from just sweeping your cane along the ground. And it also has a touch pad on the handle, which is used to control the WeWalk app. And the app is installed on your smartphone, and that provides you your navigation instructions while you're out and about. So two products that kind of tie together. Now, for me personally, this has always been something that has sounded interesting, but I've just kind of dismissed it. And not because it's a bad product, but just because for the last 7 years I've been a guide dog owner. So I very rarely use the cane. You know, I might use my cane if my dog was ill, or if I was going somewhere that wasn't really appropriate to take her, or if, you know, I was going on holiday or something like that. But I just didn't use the cane enough to justify paying what's close to £600 for something that I wasn't going to use much. But sadly, about 3 months ago, my guide dog, Iggy, passed away. And there's all the emotions and adjustments that come with that, which I'm not going to get into here. That's for another show entirely. But one of the things that was really important to me and that I wanted to carry on doing was travelling. Because, you know, I work in Manchester, so I, you know, travel into the office. Sometimes I might work away in other locations. I've got friends and family who live a bit of a distance away. And to be completely honest, I enjoy travelling. I enjoy being out and about and going places independently. And before I got Iggy, before I, you know, I was matched with her, I used to use the cane. So I've been using the cane for probably about 10 years, if not more. But I always got on fine. I could, you know, navigate around. But I just never felt completely confident and comfortable with it. You know, certainly not as confident as I did with the dog. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to be using the cane for the foreseeable future. I am in the process of applying for a new guide dog, but as we all know, it can be quite a long way at the minute. So I thought, well, in the meantime, maybe this WeWalk could help me with that, you know, with that confidence, having the obstacle detection and things like that. Now, I should just say that this is not in any way a replacement for having good cane skills and having orientation and mobility training and cane training and things like that. It doesn't replace that. So you still, if you're not familiar with, you know, how to use a cane, then you shouldn't just dive straight in with the WeWalk. But I just thought maybe having that, being able to control my navigation remotely and being able to have that extra obstacle detection, maybe that would just help my own personal confidence a bit. So I bought one recently and I'm going to just talk you through it and share my thoughts on it, because when I was looking into this, there was nothing that really went massively in depth on it that I found. So I thought I'd try and address that here. And I know that was a bit of rambling before we get into this, but I just thought it was important to give you that bit of context as to my experiences and where I'm coming to this from. Because I think if depending on how confident you are with the cane and how familiar you are with the cane, your views of this product are going to vary quite massively. So it's definitely a bit of a personal one, this one. I'm going to start off with the WeWalk app, because the app is available to everyone, regardless of whether you've got the smart cane or not. If you have got the WeWalk cane, then the app is free. If not, then there's a monthly or yearly subscription cost to it. So the app is available on both iOS and Android. And on iOS, it is £12.49 per month, or you can pay £102.99 a year. And that will give you full access to the WeWalk app and all of its features. I assume the pricing is the same on Android, but just double check on the Play Store before you get it for the latest pricing. And the app would be pretty familiar to you if you've used things like Blind Square or Good Maps or, you know, other similar navigation apps, then you'll be quite familiar with the app, really. But there are a couple of standout features of this which I really like. And I will be, of course, sharing the negatives here as well, because there are some downsides to the app and to the cane, unfortunately. But let's just get into it and we'll explore it as we go. So I've got my iPhone 13 Pro here with VoiceOver, and let's jump into the WeWalk app.
WeWalk. WeWalk. Home. Heading.
So I've opened the app, and as you'd expect, the first place we land is the homepage. I'm just going to flick to the right.
My current location. Save location. Button.
Now, I skipped that there because that first bit is my current location, and that tells you your exact location. In my case, though, it's going to read out my home address, which don't really want all my fans queuing up outside my door like that would happen. Anyway, so your that bit there tells you your current location. And then as
home,
you heard,
heading.
You've got the save location button there.
My save location button. Share my location button.
You can also share your location as well.
Exploration mode, switch off.
Now, exploration mode, If you turn that on and then just leave the app running, as you walk around, it's just going to call out places that are around you. So it might tell you things like street names, local businesses, local points of interest, and places that you've saved as well. So you could just leave that running, and as you're walking around or driving around, if you're in a taxi or in a car with someone, it will just give you a little prompt as to where you are and what's nearby. So I'll keep flicking to the right.
Connect your smart cane button.
There's the button to connect your cane if you have one. Mine's disconnected at the minute.
Explore button.
The explore button is where you can see all your categories and places nearby. So if I double tap.
All button.
So we can just have all the places, and then we've got a list of categories here. So I'm just going to flick right to navigate through these.
Arts and entertainment button. Food and cafes button. Professional and others button. Shops and services button.
So all your kind of usual categories as you'd expect there. Let's go back to food and cafes. Never say no to a bit of food.
Food and cafes button. Food and cafe. Back button. Food and cafes. Refresh button.
And then these are all the places that fall into that food and cafes category.
Places. Halton Fish Bar, 590 metres behind you. Tavern Fair, 600 metres, slightly right. The Mustard Seed, 860 metres, slightly right.
So as you can hear, it's telling me the name of the place, and it's telling me how far I am away from it, and roughly the direction that it's in as well. And I could double tap on that, and I would get the options of, you know, being able to view the place's full address and being able to start a route to navigate there and things like that. So I'm going to back out of here.
All button. Home. Heading.
Now the next bit.
Transport button.
Is the transport section. And this is what I really like. So this app is actually using two sources. It's using Google Maps for your current location and places nearby. But then it's also using Move It, which we've covered before. That's the public transport app that, you know, gives you info on public transport lines and places around you, and will also give you stop alerts as well. So when you're about to approach your stop, it will give you an alert. Say you sat on the bus and you're approaching your stop, it'll give you an alert when you're two stops away, and then one stop away, and then an alert when it's time to get off. And WeWalk ties into that as well. So if we double tap on transport.
Transport, all button. Sutton Road, 260 metres behind you. Addington Road, 330 metres straight to the right.
So, I mean, that's pretty standard. We've gone into a transport category, and then we've gone to it's then showing us all the list of the bus stops that are nearby. There's not really any train stations in this area, so it's just showing bus stops. But it would show train stations as well if they were close by. But then if I double tap on one of these.
Addington Road, 330 metres, straight to the right. 3 Cranberry DR, Cranberry DR, built.
That's the address.
Transport lines, button.
And then we double tap on transport lines. It will tell me all the buses that are going to be arriving and how far away they are.
Transport, back button. Addington, refresh, but approaching lines. 930 Gilno, 4 minutes. 7 Bolton, 11 minutes. 7 Bolton, 25 minutes. 7 Bolton, 40 minutes.
So there you go, that's telling you the number, so the bus number, where it's going, and how long it will be before it arrives. And if the transport line supports it, so in other words, if it works in Move It, then it will work in WeWalk. So if the transport line supports live GPS tracking, then that is what WeWalk will use. So I just find this really nice. It's nice to have this, you know. I know some people find the interface of Move It a little bit complicated, so this is a bit of a nicer interface. Obviously, it's not full-featured Move It. You don't get all the features, but that's where it's pulling its data from. And
7 Bolton, 39 minutes.
Yeah, it's counting down for that bus. But that's where it's, you know, pulling its data from and putting it into this nice, accessible interface. But these two things, Google Maps and Move It, also tie together in terms of planning routes and navigating routes as well. So if I go back out of here and go back onto the homepage.
Addington Road, selected. Back button. Home, heading.
Now, we've got the Explore and we've got the Transport. The option after that is Navigate, which will just allow you to type in a place name or type in an address and navigate to it. And then at the bottom, you've got My Places. So I'm going to go into...
Preferences, tab.
I'm going to go into the My Places section.
My Places, button. My Places, home, 10 meters, straight to the right.
And these are all the places that I have saved or, you know, bookmarked, if you like. And I'm going to go to one of them in particular because it will show you how these two services tie together.
Three pigeons, 300, Bolton bus interchange, 3.40 kilometres behind you.
Now, Bolton bus interchange is our local bus station, and the kind of easiest way to get to it from here is by taking the bus. So I'm going to double tap on that.
Bolton bus interchange, 3.40 kilometres, Newport Street, go there, button.
Now, if we tap on go there.
From your current location, button.
Yep, that's correct, from my location.
Swap start and to Bolton bus interchange. Walking, 48 minutes.
So that's the first option. That's just a walking route, and that would take 48 minutes. But if we flick to the right...
Transport, 22 minutes. Walking, then 20, then walking.
So that's walking, and then one bus, and then walking. If we flick to the right again...
Transport, 23 minutes. Walking, then 7, then walking.
And that's similar. So a bit of walking, then a bus number, and then walking again. And if we double tap on this route, we can see more details of what exactly we're going to be doing.
Selected. From your current location, button. Back button. Navigate. Heading. Start. Button.
The start button would start it tracking on that route and giving us directions.
Start from Wigan Road. 1. Walk to Wigan Road. 2. Wait for 7. 3. Ride to Bolton Interchange. 4. Walk to. 4. Walk to.
Okay. I don't know why it just says walk to at the end. So you saw there was 4 steps there. Well, 3 steps really, because I don't know what that last one was. But it was walk to Wigan Road, which is the bus stop, wait for the number 7, and then exit the number 7 at Bolton Interchange. And what it would do is, if I were to click start, it would give the walking directions to the bus stop. Once I'd got there, I would tap the I've arrived button, and it would straight away then start counting down for the number 7, and it would start tracking the number 7 and letting me know how long it would be before that bus arrives. Once I've got on the bus, I can tap on the got on button. Then it would start counting down the number of stops. So I might say you're 10 stops away, 9 stops away, 8 stops away, etc, etc. It would give me the alerts when I'm 2 stops, 1 stop, and then when it's time to exit, exactly the same as Move It does. Once I'm off the bus, I just tap on got off, and if there was more to do on that route, say there was another set of walking directions, it would immediately switch back to those. So I just find this really nice, because what I used to do previously was I would have something like Soundscape running or Blind Square running for my walking directions. Then when I got on the bus, I would switch over to Move It and set my stop and, you know, do all that. And then I'd get the alerts from Move It. Then I'd get off the bus, and then I might have to wake the app up that I was previously using or start it again and put in my end location at that point. Whereas you don't have to do that with this. If it gets the route that you're looking for, then it ties it all into one app and it works really, really nicely. The WeWalk team call this multimodal navigation. And I've found that really useful. And maybe it's not specific to WeWalk. Maybe there are other apps that do this, and you know, of course, do let me know. But I've never really seen this before. So that's a feature that I really do like. There is also an Uber option on the planner route screen as well. So that's another app that it integrates with. So Uber and Lyft are two options in there. So if you've got either of those, you can request an Uber or request a Lyft from the app, and it will send your current location as well as your destination through to the Uber or Lyft app as well. So it's very, very nice and well integrated with various services. I mentioned downsides. Now, the main downside that I've seen of the app itself is there's no option to customize the speech on iOS. So in the preferences, which I'm not going to get into, but in the preferences, there's quite a few options for customizing the visual settings. So you can change the theme, you can change the text size and all those kind of features. But there aren't any options to change the speech rate or the pitch or the voice that is used. And I did ask this question to WeWork. I did ask if they would consider implementing this or if it was something that I was missing. And they said, no, it's not possible on iOS. Apparently it is possible on Android. You can change the options on Android, but not on iOS. So you won't have heard it on that demo, but when you're, for example, navigating and it's giving you the directions of, you know, turn left, turn right, things like that, it uses a different voice and it uses the iOS system voice. Because for normal usage, I have VoiceOver set quite fast. And one thing that stood out to me was that as soon as I started navigating, it was using the default voice, so the Daniel voice in my case, and it was speaking very, very slow. And I was looking through the preferences, trying to adjust it, and there wasn't an option. So you can actually change the voice. So if you go to outside of WeWork, if you go to the iOS settings, then accessibility, and then spoken content, you can change the voice itself in there, but you can't change the speech rate or pitch or any other settings. I think there are sliders in that spoken content section for rate and pitch, but they don't have any effect in WeWork. So that was a bit disappointing to me. I feel like that's something that has been really overlooked, in my opinion. You know, most people, you know, maybe you're not too bothered about that, but for me, I like being able to customize the voice and have things speak the way I, you know, want them to. And it just feels like it's been a bit overlooked. You know, they've put all the vision features in there, which is amazing, but it would be nice to have the same kind of flexibility for the speech. Now, WeWork did say that this is something they'll look into, but it's not going to be added anytime soon. So that's just something to bear in mind. And that did bug me at first. That did take a bit of getting used to. But as I said, I do really like the multimodal navigation features. So that's a really quick overview of the app. And then next time I will go over the cane itself and show you how all these things, the cane, the app, the multimodal navigation and all that works in the real world.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Welcome in to our fireside chat. We have a cast of characters joining us to talk about current trends in technology as we celebrate Global Accessibility Awareness Day and perhaps reflect on some of the announcements from earlier this year at the CSUN conference and the Consumer Electronics Show. We are joined by RNIB's Lead of Inclusive Design, Robin Spinks, Darren Pascal, who heads up the Vitalize project for Thomas Pocklington Trust, currently on secondment with Guide Dogs. And we are also joined by Steve Tyler, Director of Assistive Technology at Leonard Cheshire. Gentlemen, welcome in. I hope I've got your titles right. I just want to take this opportunity for the four of us, all of whom I think take a keen interest in the world of technology and how trends affect our experience as blind and partially sighted people. And also, I think for you, Steve, working for a pan disability organisation, what some of the current trends mean for you as well. So I just want to go around each of you and just give me as kind of a 30 seconds on what you're looking at the moment and where your main kind of area of interest is. Robin Spinks.
Hi folks, good to be here. So yeah, Robin Spinks, Head of Inclusive Design at RNIB. The big thing that is, well, one of the big things that's interesting me at the moment is, of course, artificial intelligence. You expected me to say that. And there's been a huge buzz over the last few months about AI with ChatGPT and Bard and a number of other AIs coming on scene. You know, the big question for me and the thing that really fires me up and gets me interested is, how can this make life more manageable more enjoyable, more engaging to those of us with sight loss and other disabilities? How can AI actually improve people's lives?
Darren Pascal, you were with us at CSUN and you managed to get hands-on a lot of the tactile technology. What role do you think tactile is going to play in the next year or so?
Hi, yeah, I think it's. I think it could be very, very exciting. It's great to see that companies, organisations seem to be acknowledging that providing access to things with alternative interfaces, but the same information that everybody else is getting, but in a format that actually works well for everybody, or in formats that work well for everybody, so you get the chance to experience the world on your terms, is really exciting. I mean, purely from the perspective of a blind person, the chance to be able to have tactile access to map information and know what I'm touching, getting that context to not only have to kind of spend a lot of time getting up to speed with whatever it is in front of me, but actually having a kind of a multimodal approach where I've got a chance for this data to be explained to me by the tactile interface, as well as experiencing it, and actually then being able to participate equally and get access to this wealth of visual information. I think that is tremendously exciting. And of course, because we're talking about tactile and because we're talking about information, it really could apply anywhere. I mean, I've obviously mentioned mapping, but it could be virtually anywhere where diagrams exist. So, yeah, really exciting. And I do hope that a lot of what we saw starts to kind of find its feet and its place in society for all of us in the, well, as soon as possible, really.
Steve Tyler, from a pan-disability point of view, what's technology doing for you just now?
I'd probably describe it as personalization, i.e. delivering information, accessibility, control of systems, control of your surroundings in different ways, in depending on what your requirements particularly need. And I'd also, for me, the other big thing is particularly dialogue-based or voice-in, voice-out services. Again, backed up by AI, but smarter delivery of information that's very specific to what you've requested.
So lots of stuff around information access, and of course Global Accessibility Awareness Day is rooted in, you know, web accessibility, and that is often about gaining access to information. Lots more ways to do that, lots more interfaces, lots more ways in which technology can digest and process and summarize and access information. Robin, tell us about some of the risks. So what are the challenges? What are the things that we need to be aware of as we move into this new era, particularly in terms of AI?
I think first and foremost, we've got to take people with us. So, you know, on this call, we're all, I guess, in an age band, shall we say, and we're all people who have studied, and, you know, we're from a certain background. I think we've got to make sure that people actually understand and can be on board with AI. We've also got to recognize that some technologies people won't be on board with, it won't be appropriate or it won't be manageable. So let's think about the context and let's think about how we can simplify things, how can we make things as easily understandable as possible, and just recognize the different starting points that people come from. Everyone on this call is a fan of technology. We recognize how it liberates people, it enables us to do stuff more easily, whether that be reading, banking, shopping, getting around, following our hobbies and interests. But you know what? A lot of people have lost their sight, for example, and they're older and they fear technology or they don't really want to engage with it. So I think above everything else, what we've got to do is create as many routes as possible to enable people to engage with this. And it's like Steve said, very simple voice in, voice out systems that are more refined than things that are currently available. That's one big opportunity for us. I think we've got to just be aware of some of the ethical concerns that there are around AI as well. You know, it's well documented questions in the media around the ethical elements and aspects of AI. and machine learning? You know, what is the role, for example, of bias? Where is there bias? How can we ensure that systems that deal with people in an automated way actually express understanding and empathy? That's a big challenge that's largely still unanswered. So lots of questions, lots of opportunities. I think a really healthy mix of challenge and opportunity, and a dynamic mix at that one.
Darren, how do we get that balance right? You've worked with Thomas Pocklington Trust, guide dogs, obviously, you know, human support, you know, support from canines as well. How do we get the amount of technology about right so that it augments our experiences and doesn't detract from those, you know, perhaps more organic experiences that we might also need?
Well, I think it's keeping the user experience, personal experience at the heart and centre of everything that we do, because ultimately, tech is at its best really serving us as a community by giving us, enabling us to have these opportunities. So I think if we're aware of the kind of dual aspect of this, that in this digital age where opportunities and expectations are increasing in the digital realm, that actually that's all well and good, and it's very important that everything and every effort is made to ensure that these up and coming technologies are fit for purpose and serving everybody. But there's also this piece of making sure that whatever we're doing is serving everybody, and acknowledging that there will always be cases where tech won't necessarily be appropriate. Finding those limitations, being aware of them, and as long as we ensure that everything, as I say, that we do has that focus of those who we're serving at the heart of what we're doing, then I think we should be in a really good a good position. And obviously an opportunity like Global Accessibility Awareness Day that we find ourselves celebrating this year today is the ideal chance to promote the needs, the aspirations and the opportunities presented by taking accessibility and looking at inclusion maybe afresh for all of us. So I think it is certainly a challenge, but I think it's one that is extremely exciting and has far more opportunity than risk or downsides, really, as long as we keep the user at the heart of everything that we do.
Sometimes there's a risk in not doing something, isn't there, you know, than the risk of doing it. Steve Tyler, you talked about voice in and voice out interfaces, and, you know, people listening to this may feel, well, that means, you know, we can actually be sort of quite relaxed now that technology, you just have to talk to it. You don't really need any skills or training. To what extent do we still need high quality training and skills development and thinking about the different ways in which, you know, people who, you know, we are on this conversation blind and partially sighted, but thinking about the disability community more broadly, what skills and training are still going to be needed into the future?
Well, this was about trends, and I've articulated what I have because I see that as coming down the track, and we've already seen Alexa and Google Home and Siri and a whole host of other personal assistants, but they're becoming smarter, becoming more accessible. Ultimately, my view is you want to be in a position where technology is so part and understands or is linked to what you do that you don't need training, that it becomes a dialogue, a bit like you would have on a human level or as close to it as you can. We all know that we're a million miles away from that. You only have to spend any time with any of the current personal assistants to know that, you know, very often you're just left dangling. If it says something like, I don't understand what you said, well, thanks very much. Where do I go from here? And it's an art form, this business of dialogue-based stuff. You know, it really is. It's not a straightforward like-for-like. You know, if you're talking about translating a web page or a tabular piece of information into a descriptive piece of dialogue with the possibility of engaging with that dialogue and drilling down into information you might want, that's a very different process to pushing up on screen and visually engaging with it. So a long way to go. But yes, I think the ambition for most people that think about it is we make the technology as seamless and efficient as possible. Sadly, a lot of the time, I think the theme of this conversation actually, is that human-centered design isn't necessarily at the forefront of the thinking in terms of development. It's more about the technology and the getting out to market first, however flaky that technology is.
Robin, I know you're someone that gets very excited about innovation in technology and inclusive design, but how do we make sure that the reality, you know, meets the or lives up to the rhetoric that we sometimes hear? You know, there's a new product, there's a new solution, it's going to change everything. And then you kind of go and try it and, well, it might be all right for a bit at certain things. How do we, you know, make sure that technology really delivers for us as a community?
I think it starts with honesty, and I think it goes back to something Darren raised as well, which is around keeping the user at the heart of the process. When the user is kept at the heart of the development process, you know, you are more likely to see something that actually does turn out to live up to the expectations. And it's also about recognizing the fact that, you know, often people are creating products for people like themselves. So if you are male, white, and in your 20s, and you're a software developer, quite often you create software that you would like to use. That isn't necessarily the software that someone who's in their 70s, who's blind, who's not very tech savvy, is going to find easy to use. So it's having the user at the heart of the journey. It's about being honest. It's about constantly testing and iterating on your product or service, and constantly looking to challenge and improve your practices, but also challenge your own assumptions. So, you know, every manufacturer and developer makes assumptions about the people who are going to use the product. We need to move away from that. We need to move to a much more honest and transparent culture of questioning and reflection, and just a general willingness to constantly push the envelope and go further.
Robin, is that about representation as well, making sure that disabled people are working in technology?
It is. You know, at CSUN, one of the things that was quite striking was to meet a company called Clusive. They're a development company who build e-learning platforms. They're US-based. But one of the striking statistics about the company is that 70% of their software developers are blind persons. So, you know, they're building from the outset solutions that actually have to work for blind people, because the people who are building those solutions are blind. So absolutely, Dave, representation is critical. How many software teams could you go into now and find a disabled person or a blind person, you know, working in that team, successfully engaged and integrated into the team, and, you know, spreading the word and actually building an ambassadorial spirit of inclusive design so that it begins to, you know, to permeate every bit of the company? That's what we've got to do. We've got to get the message about inclusive design everywhere across companies, but not just get it there, keep it there. Make sure that there are systems and processes that enable learning to be retained, because there's going to be a new customer experience manager, right? There's going to be new branding. There's going to be a new platform used by the company. Each time that a shift like that happens, inclusive design has to stay at the heart of it. And it's quite challenging.
Of course, blind people themselves have led innovations in specialist technology. I'm thinking of screen reading, JAWS, Talks, you'll remember from the old Nokia days. Many of those products were spearheaded and led by blind people. So we absolutely need to be at the heart of this. Darren, you've got a few hats, given your relationship with Thomas Pocklington Trust and with Guide Dogs. And of course, you joined us at RNIB when we went to CSUN. So you get around. And of course, we're all here to talk about technology for global accessibility Awareness Day. How do we make sure that all these sort of organisations across our sector are complementing rather than competing? Or do we need to compete? How do we minimise the duplication, or do we need a little bit of duplication sometimes?
That's a really good point, Dave. I think collaboration is absolutely key. And one thing that has really struck me in my relatively short amount of time of working in the VI charity sector over the past few years is how there has, it seems to me, been a real shift in attitude from kind of operating as perhaps slightly individual entities to actually looking at ways where we can work together more, because we've, I think, started, whilst we've been going through this sort of journey, to realise that actually in looking to serve a lot of the same kind of people in various situations, surely it makes sense for us to be working more together. And so it's been a real privilege for me this year to actually very much be in a position where, in some respects, you could say I'm embodying this, by the fact that I'm actually seconded this year to work on a collaborative tech digital project with guide dogs from Thomas Bocklington Trust. And I think it's great to see that this is happening. I think if we're going to be honest and bold and courageous about the challenges that digital accessibility and access to technology are presenting at the moment, the only way that we can ensure that we respond and ensure that those who we are serving are at the heart of these solutions is to work together and constantly look for those opportunities of engagement and make sure that we can do our bit collectively together.
Steve Tyler, to what extent do you think the industry gets it? You know, are we just kind of a fringe movement, sort of, you know, tapping on the window, or do you think accessibility is really, you know, at the heart of technology product development these days?
Before I answer that, very quick word of warning, really. One, I would say, just on the previous bit of the conversation, we've got leadership in the disability world by people with disabilities, absolutely crucial. Why, how could I ever disagree with that? There is an art/science, though, in an ability to translate user need into outcomes and or user requirements into genuinely beneficial outcomes. And that includes, you know, observational work. It includes engaging people, because though I want to say having people at the heart of the community and leading the developments is a critical thing, and I believe that with all my heart, I've also seen examples where that's gone horribly wrong, because believe it or not, blind people can be just as biased as anybody else around how stuff should work. So having said that, does industry get it? Well, the short answer is twofold. One, a very long way to go simply doesn't begin to cover it. So the latest WebAIM statistics, there are all sorts of reasons for this. I can justify the reasons for it and tell you chapter and verse on why these situations exist. But stick with the numbers, because they just tell the story you need to know. Over 96% of home pages are inaccessible. We're still in a situation where people in inclusive education are not being included. We're still at a place where vast numbers of people with disabilities that could do a job and want to do a job don't have a job and can't do a job. So no, they don't get it. Why is that? Frankly, I think we've confused everybody. I think especially now there is a lot going on in the world of diversity, inclusion, belonging. There are all sorts of words like that which try to capture an absolute massive multitude of issues. And we know that when we talk about people with disabilities, on the one level, you know, there are some big numbers that people can be proud of in marketing land, like 14.4 million people with disabilities in the UK, or, you know, 1.8 million people with visual impairment. And we even refer to them as communities. Well, one, they're not communities. to, they're not uniform, sadly. So the terrible part of the story is, yes, they are difficult to reach. Yes, personalization is an issue. And yes, you do have to do a bit of work to actually understand your customer. And ultimately, I think we need to go right messaging that we give, i.e., if you're serious about being customer obsessed and delighting your customer, we maybe ought to do a bit more in terms of understanding what customers want and need.
Final thoughts then, Robin Spinks.
I think keep the user at the heart of every part of the journey. Never lose sight of that, because the importance of it is critical. And should you decide to deviate from that path, you will, you know, you will experience the consequences, and your customers will too. So keep the user at the heart of everything.
Darren?
Well, definitely. I've been saying it a lot, haven't I? Keep the user at the heart of everything. But I think for anybody who might be new to this whole question of accessibility and coming at this for the first time this year, what I would say especially is welcome. And here we are. Come and engage. Come and, if you want to learn more, you know, reach out and let's have those conversations. If you're a software developer and you're looking to expand your engineering team and are looking for a more diverse team, there are organizations out there who can help with that. Equally, if you want to ensure that you have that accessibility integrated into your product life cycle and want it to be part of your quality assurance processes as it should be, then we can help with that as well. So be bold, be brave, be willing to be vulnerable, and let's have that conversation and see where it gets us.
Steve?
I think my message would be to the voluntary sector, to the sector that represents the needs of people with disabilities, blind and partially sighted people. I think we need to encourage the younger generation coming through the education system and employment to champion accessibility. I think we've bought ourselves a little bit of a problem recently, which is that there is a generation of us that have grown up with accessibility built in, and the expectation is set. And no one quite understands, one, how it got there, and two, I would say, how delicate that ecosystem is. I think accessibility, unfortunately, is still not quite an afterthought. And of course, there are exemplary entities, people, etc., that deliver on it. But nonetheless, it hangs on a slender thread, I would say. And we need to make sure that we support it properly through new champions.
And something on which I think we can probably all agree is accessibility is not just about a day. It's not just about a checklist. It's a mindset. Robin Spinks, Darren Pascal, Steve Tyler, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
That's it. That's all we've time for this week on Tech Talk. Do tune in next time when we'll be hearing from Microsoft and some of the announcements that they are making for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. From myself, Dave Williams, and Callum Stoneman.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.